Bishop Angelos, a year since 21 Coptics were beheaded in Libya, and you're obviously keen to commemorate that anniversary, which is only natural. But what impact do you think, if anything, have their deaths had in and around that region?
It was quite astounding that although we've seen persecution of Christians for the past decades, and many of the attacks have gone completely unreported, that this one seemed to have a resounding impact not only in the region but around the world. It seemed to touch a lot of people, whether it was because of seeing the horrific nature of the crime, the resilient nature of the, you know, the 21 Copts who died, or the forgiving nature of their families and their communities. So it did have a huge impact on people within our community and throughout the world community, I think, then. And the reason I think we want to commemorate it now is just to make sure that that feeling doesn't go away, that understanding that kind of activity crossed a line that it shouldn't have crossed in our own humanity at the moment, with our human rights declarations and our baseline human rights expectations, and then seeing people not only persecuted but actually beheaded for their faith in this manner, I think is a stark reminder that we need to be vigilant that those lines don't get crossed again and that the levels we have now don't keep slipping.
You talked about the reaction there from different types of people, perhaps different faiths and from different parts of the world. But what about the reaction from possibly other faiths, Muslims, in that part of the world, in Libya, in North Africa, in the Middle East? What kind of reaction did you see or hear from those people there?
We had an immensely sympathetic and empathetic reaction from many Muslims in the region. I can honestly say I didn't hear a single triumphalist message at that time. No one, I think, besides the people who put out that horrible video, no one really took pride in what happened, because I think it was a condemnation of a kind of action that dehumanized very simple men who had just gone to support their families. They weren't on a political mission or anything like that. They went from poor villages to support poor families, and they were used as pawns and bargaining chips. They were used to make a statement, and they were used to potentially instill fear into people's lives.
It's obviously one of the high-profile examples that we have seen of extremists, of Islamic State, so-called Islamic State, and the kind of barbaric attacks that they have carried out. But we hear other reports of the problems of the violence being meted out to Christians in that part of the world. And there have been several high-profile voices calling for it to be called a genocide. Now, what is your reaction to the idea of describing that violence currently happening to Christians and different minorities as a genocide?
Well, I agree completely that it's continued. So just a month after what happened to the 21 Copts, 30 Ethiopian Eritrean Christians were also killed in a very similar manner. And since then, people have been abducted, people have been killed. People are still missing. I've been involved quite a lot with initiatives here in our own parliament, particularly with people like Lord David Alton and colleagues in the UK Parliament in both houses, as well as in the US, who have been trying to designate this as genocide. And if we look at the definition of genocide, it's a deliberate killing of a large group of people, or an ethnic group, to try to annihilate them. And these people are a large group in the Middle East, It is an ethnic group. Now, the complication we have here is that they're also a religious group. And unfortunately, because of the way people look at religion, it's almost seen that we can't apply the genocide rule to them because they come from a certain faith. Now, these people have been part of the fabric of the Middle East community of their societies for sometimes 2,000 years. So it is very much an ethnic group as well. Religion isn't so separable in the Middle East. So when you're a Christian, you're a Christian, that's part of everything you are. Likewise, if you're a Muslim or a Yazidi. So it only seems appropriate that if that is the definition, then it should be applied. The danger I see is if you apply the definition to one group but not another. So there's a welcome from some quarters to apply the genocide designation to Yazidis but not to Christians. Now, my concern with that is people on the ground, perpetrators of these crimes, will see that one group has now received international protection while the other group continues to be a soft target.
There are many faiths and, as you say, cultures and different, I think particularly of Armenians and Sikhs spring to mind. People who have wanted to have past events, mass killings, described as genocide, and the international community has never been able to come to a definite consensus on whether they should or should not be counted. And there is a lot of anger around that. Do you sense a danger that, as you say, by picking one but not another, you can cause anger from other parts of the world, from other communities, who might see themselves, therefore, as second-class citizens to perhaps the Christians?
Well, I do think that you can cause anger, but more than that, as I was saying earlier, you cause almost a legitimate attack on the groups that are not protected.
So those would be the ones who you say are not included in the genocide?
The ones who are not included. And, you know, as a Christian and as a Christian bishop, I would never, ever just petition or advocate for the protection of Christians. I think these kinds of laws, these kinds of designations should be blind to religion, to ethnicity, and should look at the facts on the ground. Is this a group of people that is threatened? Is this a group of people that falls within the definition? If the answers are yes, then whether they are from a religious group or not, then they should be covered. Because I think, you know, as a Christian, I believe in the sanctity of all life, of every person. And I would want the protection of every person, because that's how I would want to be treated and want to treat others.
And of course, it's not just Christians who are falling victim to the violence, particularly in Syria, but also in Iraq and surrounding places. I mean, just this week, we've obviously seen the huge numbers of refugees fleeing towards the border with Turkey within Syria and being held up there. What have you made of the ongoing and increasing humanitarian problems?
You know, it's tragic. I was in Erbil last year, and I was also on the Greek-Macedonian border and saw the camps at both ends of that journey. And it's tragic to see complete families forced to move, displaced. When we look at the refugees that are now on the Turkish border, it's difficult to understand what they're going to do. They've left a city that's being bombed, and they're going to another place where they're seeking refuge, and they're not let in. I personally feel, and this has been my opinion for a long time, that it's very important for us to address and respond to immediate needs. Immediate needs, humanitarian needs, health needs, and anything else that arises. But at the same time, we need to look at the longer term, more legitimate solution. No matter how many refugees we can take into the Middle and into Europe, and I think we should try to help as many people as we can while we are still careful and vigilant for security purposes, but no matter how many people you take in, we're talking about tens of millions displaced. And unless we are able to solve the situation there on the ground, allowing people to live with their dignity, allowing people to live with enough to provide for themselves, to live safely, where they're able to, like you and I, live their lives, practice their faith, provide for their families. Unless we do that, this is a bottomless well of people who just will not be able to be absorbed by the Europe or anywhere else. And from speaking to many people on the ground, I know for a fact, in speaking to churches and other organizations, most people don't want to leave their country. They're only leaving because they have to. If we're able to provide security and safety and provision and dignity for them, they're going to stay where their families are, where their heritage is, where their memories are, and be able to live the same kind of freedom that we enjoy here.
So you would say the arguments that we have ongoing, the endless debate really about whether we should be accepting more refugees into the UK or how can Europe best absorb them, is perhaps the wrong debate to be having. We should be focusing more on how we solve the problem and how we allow them to stay within their original homelands.
I don't think it's the wrong debate, but I think it needs a two-prong approach. As I said earlier, we do need to respond to the very immediate humanitarian disaster that is there. When people are risking their lives and on what they call death boats, I met people in the camps that were saying they came on death boats. Now, if they've made that journey, we have to respond to people who have made that journey. But at the same time, we need to look at the longer-term, more pragmatic approach of how do we stop that hemorrhaging of people? To stop them from making these life-threatening journeys. At the end of the day, we are looking at the refugees as a problem. They're not the problem. They are a result of a problem. And the problem is that Iraq, Syria, Libya, and other countries have fallen into such a state that it is unviable, it is unsafe for people to continue living there. And so they take these treacherous journeys because they don't feel they have another option. And unless we protect these environments for them, their homes, their cities, then they will stay. But whatever we try to do, and I am so thankful to the British government for wanting to take in initially 20,000, and many people snigger at that, but it's a start. It's a start, and we hope that it will increase with our support here, but also, as I said, with the right security vetting. But no matter how many you take, what's the magic number? Is it 20,000, 100,000, a million? We are still speaking about tens of millions of people that cannot be absorbed by any means into Europe.